Good afternoon, sister and brothers in the Dharma. I'm so glad to be here, the Zen Center of Ann Arbor, Michigan. And this is my second time here. The first time is almost 10 years ago. Can you hear me?
Microphone closer to the mic.
This thing, can you hear me? They still cannot. This thing. This thing. Doesn't work. This thing. This thing. Not on, I think. There it is. This thing. Okay. I come from Burma. Okay, so this is the second time I'm here. The first time is almost 10 years. 10 years, 11 years ago. And I have learned many different meditation techniques in Burma. And however, I choose the most difficult one, but most beneficial to you, I think. That is contemplation of the mind. I think many of you have learned contemplation of the body, maybe of the feelings, but I believe only few people know how to contemplate the mind, because the mind is so fast. When you start to aware your mental state, many mental state has already passed away. And this contemplation of the mind is greatly connected to our emotions. And in order to have a happy life, we need to know how to deal with our different states of mind, or different states of emotions, different types of emotions. Therefore, this is the only topic I want to share today. Okay. So Buddha taught this contemplation of mind in Majjhima Nikaya and Nikha Nikaya in the discourse of four foundations of mindfulness. There are four. Number one is contemplation of the body. Number two, contemplation of feelings. Number three, contemplation of mind. And number four, contemplation of different state, or contemplation of Dharma, or phenomena. So this contemplation of mind is one of the four foundations of mindfulness. And this four foundation of mindfulness is very popular in Theravada teaching. In the Theravada school, all Theravada school practice four foundations of mindfulness. Okay. And how bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind as mind? Here I would like to read what Buddha said first before I go into details. Here a bhikkhu understands mind affected by lust as mind affected by lust, and mind unaffected by lust as mind unaffected by lust. He understands mind affected by hate as mind affected by hate, and mind unaffected by hate as mind unaffected by hate. He understands mind affected by delusion as mind affected by delusion, and mind unaffected by delusion as mind unaffected by delusion. He understands contracted mind as contracted mind, and distracted mind as distracted mind. He understands concentrated mind as concentrated mind, and unconcentrated mind as unconcentrated mind. So this is the instruction how to practice mindfulness of the mind, mindfulness of mind. So when you listen to this short, brief instruction, do you know how to practice? You do not know, right? Therefore, it's not easy subject. Okay. Buddha say you must understand mind affected by lust. Sometimes our mind is affected by lust, sometimes as hatred, sometimes affected by delusion. So when our mind, let's say, is affected by lust or by hate, let's say by hate. So when your mind is affected by hate, how you respond to your hate? How you respond to your hate when the mind is affected by hate?
With hate.
So you respond with hate. Therefore, you don't understand a mind affected by hate as a mind affected by hate. Because you grasp the hate as mind. This is the problem. You do not see a mind affected by hate, just a mind affected by hate. When the hate arises in our mind, owing to the latent tendency of ignorance, we quickly grasp the hate as my hate, my hate. Therefore, I have to respond with hate. This is the problem. And this is the problem of the world nowadays. So Buddha said, you must understand mind affected by hate is just a mind affected by hate. And that mind affected by hate is not myself. It's not mine. Hate is not mine. It's not myself. This is what Buddha meant. Unfortunately, because of the latent tendency of ignorance and identity view, we immediately identify hate as mine, hate as I, hate as myself. The moment you grasp the hate as myself, you have to respond with hate, because the mind is trapped in the delusion. So you must have mindfulness. When the hate arises in you, the mindfulness must know hate has arisen in my mind. Know it. As you know the hate has arisen in the mind with mindfulness, then mindfulness will not respond to the hate. Mindfulness just know hate as hate. Mindfulness hold on to the mental state. It does not respond immediately. And mindfulness alone is not enough. Nowadays, in America, many people practice mindfulness. But I feel mindfulness alone is not enough for liberation. It's enough for you to hold on your emotion, but it's not enough for freedom of the heart. Therefore, we need another mental factor, which is wisdom. Wisdom. So, when the head arises in our mind, mindfulness know the head has arisen, then hold to it. It does not respond. And wisdom must understand head is just a mental factor. Head is impermanent. Head is not a self. Head is suffering. So wisdom must be able to penetrate what is this head. Only then you can be free from the grip of the head. You can be free from the further reaction towards the head. And you save yourself. You protect yourself. You save yourself from committing unskillful actions owing to the head. Owing to head. If we do not have these two, mindfulness and wisdom, as an ordinary person who do not practice mindfulness and wisdom, they will immediately react to the hate, react to the lust, react to the jealousy, react to the delusion, ignorance, and so on. Because they are not practitioner. But we are practitioner. So we cannot behave like them. Right? In order to protect ourselves, not to behave compulsively, then we have to apply mindfulness and wisdom. Okay. So when the mind is affected by lust, then you must understand it's a mental state of lust. Understand a mind is affected by lust as a mind affected by lust, and that lust is not my lust. La is not mine. It's not I. It's not myself. This is what Buddha meant here. Okay. And he understands contracted mind as contracted mind. Sometimes, during meditation, you feel very sleepy. Even listen to the Dharma talk, you feel very sleepy. At that moment, your mind will tell you, I am sleepy, I am sleepy. And you do not understand. At that moment, it's just a mind affected by... you don't understand, it's just contracted mind as contracted mind. You think I'm sleepy. You identify the contracted mind as myself. Therefore, you are carried away by your sleepiness. That's what Buddha meant. You must understand contracted mind as contracted mind. And contracted mind is not myself. It's just a mental state. And whatever mental state is impermanent, never last. Therefore, you don't feel sleepy throughout the sitting, right? Only 10 minutes or 20 minutes. This shows that it's impermanence. Okay. And distracted mind as distracted mind. Sometimes during our meditation, also the mind becomes very distracted. And we don't understand, it's just a distracted mind. It's a distracted mental state. And owing to the latent tendency of identity view, we immediately identify that distraction as my distraction, or I am distracted, and get upset with that distraction. When you get upset with that distraction, things become even worse, because you already identify that distraction as I already. You are not free from the refinements. You are not free from the false identity. Okay, and Buddha further say, he understands concentrated mind as concentrated mind. Yeah? For those who practice concentration, for example, mindfulness of breathing, sometimes the mind gets very calm. And this person, you know, become very contented, even become conceited. I have such a good concentration. And the neighbor of mine is so distracted, moving here and there. And he becomes so conceited. And he forgets that concentrated mind is just concentrated mind. He identifies the concentration as my concentration and become conceited. Okay, this part is just mindfulness. No. Concentrated mind as concentrated mind, distracted mind as distracted mind. Now Buddha further explained how to practice insight. Now Buddha said, in this way, he abides contemplating mind as mind internally, or he abides contemplating mind as mind externally. Here he says he abides contemplating mind as mind, not mind as myself. Right? Buddha said, yeah? I repeat. In this way, he abides contemplating mind as mind. Not mind as I. Not mind as myself. Right? Mind as just mind. Mind is impermanent. Right? Mind is not I. Okay? Or he abides contemplating mind as mind internally. Nowadays, I think most of the teachers do not teach contemplation mind or body externally. Most teachers only teach internally. Am I right? But Buddha mentioned here, you must contemplate mind, feeling, body internally as well as externally. Why? Because we do not only attach to our mind, body, feelings. We also have a lot of attachment to external person. Your spouse, your son and daughters, your parents, your relatives, your friends, and your lovers, and so on, your beloved one. We have very strong attachment to external person. So in order to understand, the external person are also composed of body, feelings, and mind. Then we have to contemplate their body, their feelings, their mind externally, in order to get rid of our attachment to them. This is the reason we have to contemplate body, feeling, and mind externally. Or he abides contemplating mind as mind both internally and externally, again and again. You contemplate your mind affected by hate internally. Sometimes you see some people get angry with you. If you do not see this person's mind as mind affected by anger, then you become offended. You feel hurt because you see him as a person. You see him as a being, as a person, as a she, as he. He hurts me. But if you can see the other person, at that moment when he abuses you, you see his mind as mind affected by hate, then you yourself have no any grudge, or you will not be hurt by him. Not only that, if you can see him as a mind affected by hate, at that moment you are developing wisdom. Wisdom, that is very essential for your spiritual growth. Therefore, it's very important to see externally whatever defilements arise in that person. You see that defilements only as a mind affected by hate, or as a mind affected by jealousy, or as a mind, or as a mind affected by cruelty, and so on. Don't see him or her as a person, as a being. Only then you can free yourself from being hurt. Or else, he advised contemplating in mind its arising factors. At this point, you must investigate why this mental state arises in you. Let's say, why hate arises in you. For example, when somebody abuse you, that abusive word contact your ear that cause hate to arise in you. So you, at that moment, you have mindfulness. You know, oh, the mind affected by hate as the mind affected by hate. But this is not enough. This is not enough. You have to investigate why that state, that mental state, a mind affected by hate, a reason arise in you. You have to investigate. Then from investigation, you know, oh, because of impingement of the abusive word, that is the cause. So this impingement is called ear contact. Ear contact is the cause for arising of the hate in you. Then you further contemplate the cause and effect. The cause and effect. Before that, I have no hate, but because on account of that abusive word, the contact of abusive word to the mind, to the ear, and the aversion arise in you. So aversion is the effect. The impingement of the ear of the abusive word is the cause. So if you can further investigate the arising factor, then you understand cause and effect. When you understand cause and effect, the non-self nature reveals very clearly to you. That's not a person, just a process of cause and effect. Without understanding the relationship of causality or cause and effect, it's very difficult to understand what Buddha say, non-self, anatta. The non-self nature must be understood by way of dependent arising. When you see the cause, you see the effect. When the cause vanishes, the effect comes to the end. So there's no a person. You cannot see any being, any person. What appears in your insight is just a process of cause and effect. So this is what Buddha said. He advised contemplating in mind its arising factors, or he advised contemplating in mind its vanishing factors. Just now I mentioned the abusive word, contact to the ear, then hate arises in you. When the abusive word vanishes, will the hate come to the end or not? Yes or no? No. Why is it so? According to dependent origination, when there is contact, feeling arises. When contact ceases, feeling ceases. But now, when there's abusive contact, then unpleasant feeling arises. When the abusive word come to end, your feeling still not cease. Why is it so? Have you ever investigated why is it so?
Clinging
to what?
Clinging to your view or to that emotion to hold on to?
Yes, right. Clinging to that emotion, to the hate or unpleasant emotion as mine.
Yeah.
The moment you cling to that unpleasant or emotion as my, I'm hurt, you know, I hate, I'm my, the hate will never disappear. And it will continue until tomorrow, day after tomorrow, 3 days, 3 years, maybe until the end of my life. So the problem is not come from the abusive word. That abusive word is impermanent. People abuse you the most only, let's say, 10 minutes. He also get tired. he doesn't want to abuse you continuously because it takes away his energy. So he gets very tired. So he abuses you 15 minutes, enough. But you suffer the whole life. Some people suffer the whole life until the end of the life. Why is it so? So the problem does not come from his abusive word. The problem comes from your clinging to that emotion as myself. You don't want to let go of that emotion, that grasping as myself or mine. I'm hurt. So you identify the hurt as my, and you grasp it until the end of life. So if you can understand the root cause of your suffering, you will never blame another party. Another party is only trigger. The root cause lies within you. So who can help you? You yourself. That's why Buddha said, rely on yourself. Yeah? The teaching of Buddha never say, rely on me. Buddha said, no, don't rely on me. I have already shown you the path. You walk on your own. He already give you everything. He already tell you what is the root cause of your suffering. So you work on that root cause. That is grasping to the self. Grasping to myself. So next time, whatever unpleasant thing happened to you, don't blame others. Remember, other is only trigger. If your heart is pure, you have no hatred, no one can make you angry. Right? Okay. So he abides contemplating in mind both its arising and vanishing factors. So even somebody poke you or somebody abuse you, then the hate arises in you. You contemplate hate, a mind affected by hate as a mind affected by hate. Then you further investigate the cause. What is the cause? The impingement, the abusive word, the cause the hate to arise. Then you contemplate this abusive word as impermanent, arising and vanishing factor, impermanent. And the arising hate is also impermanent. This is what Buddha meant. He contemplate in mind both its arising and vanishing factors. This covers two aspects. Investigating the cause and effect. Then second, contemplate that mental state as impermanence repeatedly until it disappears. Until that mental state disappears. Okay, then the next sentence is very, very important sentence. If you do not reach this state, you will never understand what Buddha said. Okay? Or else, mindfulness that there is mind is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and repeated mindfulness. Again, or else mindfulness that there is mind. His mindfulness must be sharp, precise enough to know that there is mind only, not myself, not I. If you contemplate your anger, let's say, now you contemplate your anger as anger, and you get very angry, then your mindfulness only understand this is myself, not this is mind, right? So what Buddha mean is that your mindfulness must be strong enough, precise enough, sharp enough to know that there is mind, M-I-N-D, there is mind only, not myself. Okay. So if you contemplate your different mental state of mind, different mental state, for example, lustful mind, hatred mind, delusion mind, and so on, and yet you still feel myself, hatred is myself, then your mindfulness is not precise. You not yet reach what Buddha said. Okay. So, or else mindfulness that is mind is simply established in him to the extent necessary for knowledge. What type of knowledge? Knowledge means insight. What type of insight? So his mindfulness must be precise to the extent necessary for insight to understand mind is not a self. Mind is impermanent. Every mental state is impermanent. Every mental state is not a self. So this type of mindfulness is required, not superficial mindfulness. Okay. For bare knowledge and repeated mindfulness. Okay. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. If his wisdom, his knowledge and mindfulness understand there is only mind, only mental state, not a person, not a being, not a self, then he does not cling to anything in the world. Okay. And that is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating mind as mind. This is how we practice contemplation of the mind. Is it clear to you? It's clear but difficult to practice. Okay. So now, after the second section, I will give you guided meditation to ask you to contemplate different states of mind. Put into practice. Right? Okay. But before that, I would like to tell you how to contemplate, what attitude you should have when practice this contemplation of mind. So first, what attitude are you practicing with? Right or wrong attitude? The watching mind, the watching mind must be free from all expectations, judgment. Don't judge. For example, you get angry, you get very angry. Don't judge. Anger is not good. This is called judgment. When you say anger is not good, you bring in the identity view. Don't judge. No judgment, okay? And no preference. I like this mental state, I don't like that mental state. There's preference. This also, you bring in the self. And no bias. Okay? Keep the mind in the middle. Watch different mental state in a dispassionate way without getting involved. So whatever mental state, later on, I will trigger your different mental state. So when you watch your mental state, try to look at your mental state at dispassionate way. Don't get yourself involved in that mental state. This is how you should train yourself while practicing this contemplation of mind. and let everything come and go without reacting to it. Whatever mental state comes, lustful, happy, sorrow, jealousy, competition, and whatever mental state arises in you, let everything come and go without reacting to it. If you react to it, you cannot see it's passing away, because you already interfere. You interfere with the phenomena, so you cannot see it's passing away. So in order to see it's passing away, you have to let it comes and let it goes. Don't interfere. And recognize phenomena like anger, joy, greed, heat, confusion, tension, fear, sleepiness, pain, happiness, depression, anxiety, remorse, and so on, as they arise. Recognize it. Recognize means mindfulness. You know. You know what's happening at your mental level, at your mental state. Let them be what they are, merely impersonal mental events. Identity view stubbornly remains intact, contaminating our mental stream, a habitual reaction to almost everything that arises as body and mind. If delusion led us to spontaneously grasp at emotions as mine or myself, the remedy is to disidentify and see phenomena as impersonal. To depersonalize or disidentify is to mentally note at any arising emotions repeatedly as mere emotion, just emotion, just emotion. Look upon these mental states dispassionately. See whatever arises as foreign, as a third party, as empty or devoid of self. In this way, one frees oneself from entanglement, from a psychological point of view. This way of looking at things allows one to step back. You don't involve. You step back. You separate yourself from your own emotions. In reality, physical and mental phenomena momentarily arise, perform a function, and naturally fall away if you do not interfere with it. For example, anger. Anger is a mental state. It momentarily arises, perform a function, make you feel very hot. And you do not grasp it, then it will go away. But if you interfere, you grasp it as my anger, it will never go away. So this is how we practice contemplation of mind. Any question? Any question you have, we clear the doubt first, then we take a break, then I will give you guided meditation, how to contemplate the mind. So before we start, please clear the doubt if you have.
Habit has some energy. When anger arises, habitually my mind grasps and I say, I am angry.
Yes.
I've been trying to practice mindfulness. How do you get over the energy of the habit? Where do you find that energy to hold back?
Mindfulness.
So mind is weak.
Therefore, you got to practice more. You practice more until you become master of your mind.
Is it important to know, when you talk about the ear connection, starts a feeling in you like hatred or something, to know why you feel that, what it is about that's going in that causes that?
Yes, this is important. But before you investigate, you contemplate your either feeling, whatever feeling, unpleasant feeling, or hate, or worry, or anxiety. You contemplate that first. Okay. By contemplating, if it goes away, you don't have to investigate. But if it does not go away, you have to investigate. Okay? Okay, any other question? Okay.
Mine's similar. Is every time I've contemplated anger, it's never, if I look deeply, it's never the original emotion. There's a, it arises because of maybe frustration or jealousy or self-esteem, fear, all kinds of things. But anger itself never would be the initial. I mean, that's what you notice first, but if you look deeply into it, nothing that ever happens can make me angry for no reason. It has to be. But you're saying not to look at that, just to...
No, if you look at it, it does not go away. Then you go deeper. Go deeper to it. What caused the anger to arise? Then what caused that another one to arise? What caused that until you find the root cause? Then you tackle the root cause. When you tackle the root cause, the effect disperses. That's very important. The teaching of the Buddha only tackle the root cause. Buddha gives an example. I think it's not Buddha. I think in a commentary, give an example. He said that there was a dog and there was a lion. And a hunter throw a stick to the dog. What would the dog do? Bite the stick. Bite the stick. It never come to the dog. It never come across to the dog to attack the hunter. But if the hunter throw a stick to the lion, what would the lion do? Attack the hunter. Lion will never bite the stick, right? So if he attack the hunter, when the hunter is killed, he will never be hurt again. Therefore, Buddha's teaching is like the lion. Directly, strictly attack the cause. So don't work on the effect. Work on the cause. You got to investigate further until the root cause. Then try to solve that root cause. Then your emotion will go away. Any other question?
So what is it that you do with the root cause when you finally get there?
I think the root cause is attachment or craving. Even Buddha already mentioned this in the Four Noble Truths. The second noble truth, the first noble truth, the truth of suffering. And the second noble truth, the origin of all suffering comes from craving or attachment. This is the root cause. And because of this attachment or craving, either to sensual pleasures or to existence. Therefore, Chinese, we want to come back to this world again and again. Disregard how suffering is existent. Why? Because of craving for existence. So, finally, according to what Buddha said, the root cause is craving or attachment, influenced by ignorance. And ignorance cloud the mind, so we cannot see clearly. We cannot see impermanence, we cannot see suffering, we cannot see non-self. Why? Because ignorance cloud the mind. So the wisdom cannot unfold. And we practice vipassana, insight meditation, in order to develop wisdom to see things as they really are, as impermanent, suffering and non-self. We have a great deal of attachment to our body. Why? Do you like your life? Do you love yourself? Do you like your life? Most people say yes. Why we love ourselves? Why we have attachment to our mind and body? Do you have attachment to your mind and body?
Yes.
Why?
But I think it's because I don't know anything else.
It's true, it's true.
What else is there? Yeah.
That's what you think you are. That's what you think is everything that you are is
right.
This. That's why.
Right.
I think most people have attachment to mind and body because they think mind and body give them happiness. They enjoy sensual pleasures through mind and body, right? Without mind and body, how can you enjoy sensual pleasures? So we think, most people think mind and body provide a happiness. And we also think it lasts for very long. At least until the end of life. It lasts for very long. So we still think it's permanent in some extent. And we also think there is a permanent self inside that you can control. There's a permanent self, there's an abiding self inside that you can control. And because of that, we strongly attach to mind and body. Because we do not see, the attachment come from not seeing mind and body as they really are. Or the attachment comes from not seeing the danger of mind and body. Or not seeing the fault of mind and body. So what's the danger? What's the fault of mind and body? They are impermanence. When you come to vipassana, you reach a stage, you only see arising and passing away. Whatever you see, your feeling, your mind, your body, just arising and passing away constantly. At that moment, you feel the oppression by constantly arising and passing away. And you imagine, whatever you see is constantly arising and passing away, and you feel the suffering and you feel the depression, can you control the whole process of arising and passing away or not? You just cannot. So when you understand you cannot control the whole process of arising and passing away, then you start to realize there is no abiding self. There's no permanent self that you can exercise the power of controlling. Then you understand there's no self. That is the aim of vipassana. Why should we practice vipassana? To see things as they really are. These are the things you have to see in order to gain disenchantment. Only when you have disenchantment, then you become dispassionate towards your mind and body. Then finally, you are willing to let go of your attachment to the mind and body. This letting go is the freedom of the heart. Okay?
You mentioned it takes wisdom to go further, just instead of the surface mindfulness.
Yes.
I notice in practice it's difficult because to have the wisdom, you have to have that mindfulness, but you're not going to get too far without the wisdom. But the wisdom's not going to develop without the mindfulness.
Right.
So it's almost...
Right. Wisdom is always accompanied with... Mindfulness is always accompanied with wisdom. Both are very close. For example, if you look at a mind affected by hate with mindfulness repeatedly, again and again, then that sustained mindfulness allowed the wisdom to unfold. So without mindfulness, wisdom cannot grow. Yes.
Why exactly am I supposed to want to let go of passion and happiness? Because I kind of like the way that feels.
Why should we let go of the passion and happiness?
Yes.
Okay, why should we let go of happiness? Okay, many times when I ask my student to contemplate suffering as impermanent, they feel very happy. I ask them to contemplate happiness as impermanent. No. Just like what you said. However, why should we contemplate happiness as impermanent? Because when that happiness actually passes away, when that happiness actually passes away, you won't feel sorrow. Can you see anything, any happiness in the world last forever? No, right? So if you can get ready first, when you feel happy, then you contemplate happiness as impermanent, impermanent, impermanent. And when that happiness actually passes away, you feel nothing. You remain equanimous because you already know happiness is impermanent, right? This is the point. Why you should see impermanence of happiness? Why you should not cling to happiness? This is the reason. Passion is the same. Passion means attachment, passionate. Whatever you attach to, if they change, then what do you feel? How will you feel? You feel sorrowful because you deeply attached to it. Now it has changed. Therefore, to free yourself from later suffering, you better contemplate impermanence first. And it's a fact. Nothing is permanent. You can check, you can prove with your own life, from when you are baby until now. Which thing you find permanent? You can check your feelings from when you were born in this world until now. How many types of feeling, billions of feeling, has arising and passing away, has changed? Do you agree?
Yes.
So in fact, we have already experienced so many impermanency through our own feeling from we were born until now, and yet the knowledge of impermanency still not deep in us, right? Why is this so? Why?
Because it breaks the illusion. Everything is not happy anymore. You think about you want to think about stuff dying. You want to think about living all the time. You're less happy. Good to go.
Okay. And another reason is that, although we have undergone so many impermanency of our feelings, our happiness, our sorrow, keep on changing all the time, never last, even for a while. But our impermanency is still not strong, I think, because we do not contemplate impermanence. When we experience it, we do not contemplate impermanence. We do not make a mark. We do not mark it. Therefore, we soon forget. If you mark it, impermanent, 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 then it imprint in your subconsciousness. It imprint there. Next time, the subconscious will tell you, it's impermanent, it's impermanent. Therefore, it's very important to mentally note, mentally mark impermanence when you actually experience it, so that it can reinforce your memory that everything is impermanent.
But it's not to say that, so if I'm happy or angry or whatever emotion comes up at that time, to recognize that the emotion I'm feeling, but it's more important to identify that whatever is the emotion, that it is impermanent.
Yes. Two steps. First, you recognize first. Is whatever emotion arises in you, you recognize it first. Without recognizing it, you want to contemplate impermanence, a bit difficult. So you recognize it by way of mindfulness. Then further on, you contemplate it's impermanent, impermanent. The moment you contemplate it, mentally mark it as impermanent, it already teaches you to let go. Indirectly, it teaches you to let go already. This is called the power of impermanence, the power of noting, the power of marking correctly. Last question, yes.
So then, is it the ultimate goal to not have feelings?
The ultimate goal is to not have happiness?
Not have feeling?
How can we have no feeling? Arahant still have feeling. Arahant, you know Arahant, the enlightened one, still have pleasant feelings. But to them, pleasant feeling as pleasant feeling, not my pleasant feeling. And to them, pleasant feeling as pleasant feeling, and all whatever pleasant feeling, all are impermanent. To them, you know. So they have feelings, but they do not attach to that pleasant feelings. Mm-hmm. We also have feeling, pleasant feeling. We have abundance of pleasant feeling, but we attach deeply to that pleasant feeling. And when that pleasant feeling passes away, we suffer again. And we long for another pleasant feeling. This is how we cycle around. Okay? Okay. So we rest for maybe 15 minutes for you to have a cup of tea, then come back here after 15 minutes. Okay?